To see all you sun-faced Buddhas this morning. So. So, today I'm going to talk on a Chinese koan. And first I'll say a bit about what koans are. Koans, or kengans in Chinese, are public case records. They're actually records of spontaneous enlightenment encounters between master and disciple. And during the golden age of Zen, the Tang Dynasty, I'm a little nervous, and my voice is shaky. It'll settle down. During the Tang Dynasty, the ancient Zen masters traveled all over the roads, the dusty roads of China, and had these encounters with each other. And they weren't written down until 100 years later. And there are three kind of major collections, the Blue Cliff Record, the Book of Serenity that I'm going to be using today, and the Mu Meng Kong, with Tin Mu. Be studying, we'll offer that in the practice period in the fall, Mu Meng Kong. So that's a little bit about koans. There's a lot of wordplay in koans. There are shouts and there are staffs. There are sometimes people hitting each other, and usually we don't like that. I don't like that. I don't like reading about that. But I guess it worked. I guess it woke some people up in those days. And there were magical whisks. They looked like just an ordinary fly whisk, but they were actually important for the Buddhist masters to enter the mountains and pacify the mountain spirits that were dwelling in those areas. So ordinary items like fly whisks and staffs were actually magical talismans, powerful talismans. So would someone read the case?
Master Ma was unwell. The monastery superintendent asked, "Master, how is your venerable state these days?" The great teacher said, "Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha."
Okay, that's the main case. And I'll say a bit about sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha first. These Buddhas were two of the 2,000 names of Buddha in a sutra called the Butsu Myoko, the Names of Buddha Sutra. And the sun-faced Buddha lives for 1,800 years, and the moon-faced Buddha lives for one day and one night. The sun-faced Buddha, now I'm going to take some liberties here with this. I'm going to use my imagination and a little bit of what I've studied and my experience. So you can challenge me after the talk, if you like. So the moon-faced Buddha is like the dark, the absolute, and also in this case, it stands for frailty, illness, yeah. Short life, not long for this world. And the sun face is Buddha is constant, vigorous. Stands for the relative realm, the everyday existence, our everyday existence, and. So differentiation, specificity, you know, our objects, things we do, relationships, that sort of thing. So that's how I see those. There's a couple ways to see those. In the case, however, I think sun-faced Buddha is Master Ma throughout his whole life, Matsu, was really a sun-faced Buddha. So now I'll tell you a bit about Master Ma. Also named Basho, not to be confused with Basho, the poet, and Matsu. So from here on in, I'll refer to him as Basho. Basho or Matsu, okay? Ma, the character for Ma, translates as horse. And apparently there's a story about Hui Neng, the sixth ancestor, that he predicted to Nan Yue, who was the teacher of Matsu, that a great horse would come to these lands and trample over everything. And that great horse is, of course, Matsu. He was a large man. They said he strode like a bull and he glared like a tiger. And he was... he's actually credited with these dialogues in the case records that came from his style of teaching, and also with the blows and the shouts. He was said to wake people up, his monks. There would be a dialogue between he and his monk, and then as it was over and it seemed to be resolved, the monk was about to walk out the door, then he'd shout his name right at the doorstep, and the monk would attain enlightenment right there. Tensho, at least. So he's a very large mythical figure. He was said to have a tongue that could stretch up and out over his nose. I don't know what the symbolism of that is, if there is any. And he had 136 enlightened successors, including Linshi, Baizeng, and Master Layman Peng. For those of you who know, these are major figures in the tradition. But there wasn't much that was written down, so it all comes down through oral history. So it's interesting now that, to go back to the sun and the moon, that we're entering the solstice soon. And the sun is increasing, the powers of the sun are waxing, and most of us really enjoy that, really appreciate that. We can have full acceptance of that. Also right now, my husband Carl told me last night that the moon is also in its waxing phase, although that'll be much shorter, it won't take as long for that to happen, but it's right now, tonight, it should be at its half moon phase. I like to go walking down at Lake Harriet, and probably some of you have seen this. There's a disc there, and on the disc, there's a saying. It's in the flower gardens, the beautiful gardens, and it says, count only the sunny days. And every time I go by it, I think, that is not our way. I really do think that, you know, because as most of you or many of you know, in Zen we say every day is a good day, and we also say, when the cold comes, let it kill you, and when the heat comes, let it kill you. But when we say kill, we mean, just let it kill. Let it kill the afflictive body of afflictions we're carrying around. Just let those die off, because we're actually dying a little bit each day anyway. So let's participate in that process. So the story, the meaning of the case is not hard to understand, but it's really hard to live. The superintendent in the story is a very busy man, lots of details to attend to, and he probably doesn't even have that much time to spend with his master. And he knows Basho is ill, so his question is pretty euphemistic and not real direct, is it? How is the master's venerable state these days? Well, because the master was sick unto death. He was actually on his deathbed. And So who knows what the superintendent was actually saying, you know, maybe what was he asking? Maybe he was saying, are you going to leave us soon? You know, all by ourselves to run this place? You know, without your guidance, without your strength? I can imagine that. So, as we grow older, many of us will be coming face to face with illness. And this is a big deal for us. We can obsess and worry all the time about our afflictions and get caught in grief over all our losses. But that wasn't Basso's way. Basso answers the superintendent in this way that's completely unconventional, and it's nothing is held back. His life's work is basically in that answer. That's his life's work. He has been becoming Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha, his entire career, his entire lifetime, and he has been sharing that, and is even sharing that teaching at the end. The case says the old masters taught even when they were ill, even when they were dying. And I know that some of you have experienced that with a younger master, Katagiri Roshi, that with his death, with his illness, he was just being himself. He was just being Sun-Faced Buddha, Moon-Faced Buddha, and that was teaching. There was a great teaching in that. There's a lot of teaching in that. Suzuki Roshi, let's see what he says about this. He says, because I've been practicing Zazen for many years, some people may say, he will not catch cold, he won't suffer from flu. But it was funny for him to stay in bed for so long. We may believe that Zazen will make us physically strong and mentally healthy, but a healthy mind is not just a healthy mind in its usual sense. And a weak body is not just a weak body. Whether it's weak or strong, when that weakness or strength is based on so-called truth or Buddha nature, then that's a healthy mind and a healthy body. So, I'm just wondering if, in the middle of illness, we can, if the one who isn't ill can tend to the one that's ill in the middle of illness. And that's a reference to a story, another case about Dongshan, and he was ill, and a monk who asked him, is there someone who takes care of you who's not ill when you're ill? And he says something like, I take care of him. And I think that means that indeed there is a chance, even in the middle of illness, even on a person's deathbed, to experience freedom. Freedom of mind, freedom of heart, and to dwell, peaceful dwelling in the moment is possible. And in fact, when I was working in hospice last year, I was, you know, and I still volunteer, I'm often very amazed at how alive people are who are in their dying process, how completely alive they are, and how they take, not all of them, but some of them are quite amazing in that it's their opportunity, and they rise to it in the sense that they simply make the most of the time they have left. And sometimes you hear people say, since my cancer diagnosis, I've lived more life than I did in all my previous years. Although it's certainly no guarantee, I've seen it. And it's a great teaching for me. In my life as a chaplain resident, in the last couple of years, that question, is there someone who takes care of, who's not ill, who takes care of the one who's ill, was really alive for me when I became ill while I was caring for others. And that was a challenge. It was a challenge. But the container of the residency was so tight. It was such a snake in the bamboo tube kind of experience. You couldn't turn to the left or turn to the right. You had to surrender. You had to let go, and you had to find that person who can care for the one who's ill. So that was a teaching beyond teachings for me. And there's a lot of different models and paradigms in the healthcare field. You know, when you think about how we talk about illness, we use words like fight and struggle and battle. We're going to battle cancer, and we're going to fight it, and all those words that are used. They're important and they're good, but they also reinforce this sense that that we are struggling with something outside of us, rather than connecting with what's within us and being with that. So how can we practice with illness, with things that come that we don't like? Because we're not Basso yet, and we don't accept everything that comes our way. We dislike some things, and we struggle still, many of us. Well, Zen practice has a lot of really good practices. Sitting in Zazen and accepting what comes up, looking directly at impermanence is a time-honored practice in Zen. Just watch how things pass away constantly. That's our life. And familiarizing yourself with people who are older, people who are sick, people who are dying. That, and seeing that is you. That person is you. See, I always give the same talk, Ben. And that's just the way it is. So, anyway, Suzuki Roshi also said that it's really great that we have this limited lifespan. You know, if we live forever, what kind of motivation would we have to wake up to do this practice? Because it's a hard practice. It's a hard practice to look at all this, to let go. I'd like to read you the verse now. That's connected to this koan. And I vow not to go on and on today, so how are we doing for time? Okay. All right, but not bad. So here's the verse. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, stars fall, thunder rolls. The mirror faces forms without subjectivity. The pearl in a bowl rolls of itself. Don't you see, before the hammer, gold refined 100 times. Under the scissors, silk from 1 loom. So, those two Buddhas are like stars falling, thunder rolling. No hesitation. It's completely manifesting. No holding back. The mirror, in the commentary, it says something pretty interesting. In ancient times, in the palace in Qin, was a mirror made of jade, which reflected all the officials so that their guts were revealed. Also, when foxes acted as humans, in the mirror only their original form showed. This is having no private secrets. Master Ma had no private secrets. He was completely transparent, and his function was that was just like a running pearl. Pearls are often used as symbols of purity of mind. In Zen, Dogen uses one bright pearl. And apparently there was a story about the harbor of Mount Langfang produces pearls which roll by themselves when put in a bowl and are called running pearls. I love all this magical stuff. And that's a metaphor for the fact that Master Ma does not keep any traces of reflection. There's no subjectivity. He's completely what he is. What you see is what you get, and there's nothing hidden. That's something, too, for us to think about. In the added verses, sayings on the verse, it says, the pearl in a bowl rolls of itself. Even if you try to grab it, it won't hold still. Don't you see, before the hammer, gold refined 100 times. Pitchers, bowls, hairpins, rings, coins, cups, dishes. Under the scissors, silk from one loom. Quilts, covers, clothing, hats, vests, collar, sleeves. So, I think the methods we use for studying ourselves and studying the way are like the scissors, the tailor's scissors, and the goldsmith's hammer. They're upaya, or skillful means. They're the tools of the patchwork monk to become sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Important tools. Well, Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha gave us the Four Noble Truths, the Third Noble Truth. There's a way out of this suffering, and that way is the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is our tool. Right mindfulness, right concentration, right livelihood, right speech, etc., etc. And our awareness and attention and our ability to relinquish or let go are some of our most important tools for becoming like these Buddhas of old. And then asking ourselves, are you sure? Is that so? Challenging yourself. And tools and methods are never foolproof. We always have to, something works for a while and then it doesn't work anymore. Then we have to try something else. And we go to a retreat and we sit in one posture. It works for a while. It's not too painful. And then after another couple hours it becomes painful and we try another position. That's the way our life is. I have a poem that I'd like to end with. So proud of myself. It's only 25 after. I'm working on this. Certainly. This poem was written by a man named Richard von Sturmer. Basso is unwell. Sun-faced Buddha, persimmon, pineapple, papaya. Moon-faced Buddha, syringe, stethoscope, scalpel. While on the bedside table, a glass of water holds the early morning light. That's nice. Oh. That's what I'll say. And what would you like to say?
Grocery shopping tomorrow at Katagiri Roshi's wife, and we were talking a little bit about this, and she talked a little bit about my Roshi was dying, and he decided to stop treatment. He had cancer, and she said that he had the mindset of doing no harm to Buddha's body, that our bodies are Buddha's bodies, and they're not just our relative bodies, they're the body of the Buddha. And so to watch how we take care of ourselves, knowing that our bodies are Buddha's bodies, and to know when the situation shifts, like you were talking about, moving and maybe not being in pain, or just seeing what it takes to take care of ourselves and to take care of Buddha's body. And I thought that was really wonderful.
Thanks. Anybody else?
I think about Tony Bowman, one of his books, one of his Jogi Horn Jin Chi books called The Blessing Way. And this old woman had cancer, and she wanted to leave the Navajo Res Hospital to have a blessing way ceremony. She said, I need to have a blessing way ceremony. I need healing so that I can die in peace. And I thought, boy, that is so, so true. Yeah. It's not about save me, take it away.
Although I remember Katagiri Roshi said, I don't know what I'll be like when I'm dying on my deathbed. Apparently he'd read some of these stories of these masters that took a bath, sat in meditation, and passed away while sitting upright. And he said, I don't know, I could just scream and scream. It could be like that. Of course he didn't, but we never know.
I remember that story. I told you that about for the son, that my son encouraged him to preach. He said, you are really uncomfortable with suffering. It's okay. You can get it out. You can yell. It's okay.
I remember visiting him one day, and he was in a lot of pain, and I hadn't seen him for a while. And I seen and saw him, he had lost a lot of weight since I'd seen him. I hadn't been visiting him for a year. It shocked me. And so I had my usual response to things. I sobbed, had a big red nose, and tears streaming down my face. It's a typical Italian reaction to life. and then I just started talking to him. And I just held his hand. And I told him all the blessings he had given me in my life. And how much better I was doing now than I had been when we first met. And wasn't life great? And we both sat there, probably for about 20 minutes. And he kind of went to sleep. And Kimoy said, that was the first time in about 24 hours that he had been without pain for a 3-hour period.
I wonder about the relationship between Master Ma and Mrs. Mason. What? I just wonder, I mean, you can tell me anything, but I think it's a blessing. What's the relationship? Can you say something?
she said she wonders what was going on between Master Ma and the superintendent, what their relationship was like. She asks me to say something about that. I would imagine that Master Ma had a lot of compassion for the superintendent and was really grateful for all the work, the service that the superintendent offered in his role. And I see his response as, when you unpack it a bit, you know, at first it just sounds kind of goofy and, you know, so then, you know, what does that mean? You know, but it's very compassionate response. You know, it just really cuts through whatever it is that's happening with the superintendent. Cuts through his, who knows what he's thinking, you know, who knows what he's experiencing. He may be experiencing grief. It's almost reassuring, you know, that Basso says, "Un face Buddha, mu face Buddha. Don't worry about me." And models that way of being for the superintendent. That modeling is very kind, I think. You know? So whether they were close or whether they weren't close, I don't think it matters. Because, as you know, when you're around someone, a teacher who's very potent and is always demonstrating with gestures and everyday acts as well as teaching the Dharma, that even a little bit goes a long way. Is that okay?
I have a related question. So, this is an interaction that if one of us had it, would likely think was pretty strange. Like, that would be a weird, if I went to see Tim and I said, "How are you?" and he said this, it would be like, "Oh, that's remarkable."
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there's a lot of intimacy in these exchanges that are hard to detect.
Mm-hmm.
From where we come, but if you study them, you'll see that there is a really deep connection between the people in the stories. I think you would agree with that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering if you have an opinion on, maybe because this type of interaction is so formal in this Chinese way, mm-hmm. and I think we're different the way we do it. And if you have some idea about what we may have gained or what we may have lost in that we don't practice it in this, quite in this way, it's not totally different. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, that question was really long. Right?
Yes.
There are no cases with questions that long.
There isn't any.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's always, in the cases, there's always, often, this setup of, you know, you can't say anything about this, but try to say something. Say something.
No. And
good. Yeah. Well, you know, in those times, supposedly, it just took a shout to enlighten someone, you know, and apparently the Buddha Dharma was alive in the land. And yet, it was also taking root in a country where there was the Confucian ideal and the formality, and often the emperor shows up. And the emperor's in this. I didn't talk about him. I didn't want to talk about the emperor today, but he shows up in this case and in a lot of other cases. Because the emperor, you know, is the patron of these monasteries and these teachers at that time. It's before the monasteries became self-sufficient. So now we don't have an emperor. The emperor has no clothes. The emperor is in here. So this is where the emperor is, not out there. Okay.
You know, when it takes away from the talk that you can say with Master Monkey comes to the question of how are you doing, I thought his response was so great in the fact that it really was about staying in work on the moment, and it's not all about me. There's a bigger element, you know, the teaching. And you know, he just kind of turned it around, and it wasn't about him, even when I guessed that.
Yeah, it's the fundamental matter. And that's always what's real. You know, so how do we harmonize ourselves with that? Phoebe?
I have a comment in response to some part of it. That was in the part where the question came up of if you're someone's teacher, you is not real. What came to my mind was, well, good luck with that. My dear is not ill.
That's right.
And then the next thing was, and who's taking care of whom, you know? Is the person who's less ill taking care of the person who's more ill, or is it the other way around? Or is it both, or is there no difference between who's taking care of whom? Because in the taking care of, it's just, you know, you're taking care of each other, or the Buddha and the universe. And clearly we have some examples of, like,
Yeah, I think, Phoebe, that's good. And one of the things I noticed working with people that were dying, especially the older generation, is that they really needed to have a sense of purpose and meaning at the end of life. And for them, all their life, that came from caring for others, doing for others. And especially as a person gets older, they do more of that than when they're younger. And good care, you know, part of it was helping them to find a way to find that meaning and to feel that they were contributing. You know, if nothing else, that they were certainly contributing to my life when I was with them. You know, giving me just by their presence, just by their teaching, their situation, and so. That makes sense. And also, what you said about who isn't ill. That's another thing Katagiri used to say that stuck with me over the years, is that, you know, we can do lots of things. We can eat a good diet, take vitamins, exercise, and meditate every day. Chant, do yoga, any number of things. And they're good things. They're absolutely important for maintaining health. But even so, even with all that, we're still not 100% healthy. we're still not 100% well. There's always a part of us that's out of balance, a part of us that's dying all the time. Cells are dying, you know. We're losing brain cells. We're losing, you know, sorry to remind you, but these things are happening. And that's what he said. And the same is true of illness then. You know, it can turn that around. It's not completely bleak. It's not just, you know, there's something alive there. We're not just a body, are we, after all, or just a mind. I like the word heart-mind in Zen, in Buddhism, to talk about who we are, about us, you know, dialogue from heart-mind to heart-mind. I like that better than Dharma combat, to tell you the truth. Dharma dialogue, and this has been wonderful Dharma dialogue today. Yeah. Yep.
When you were people who are dying often feel well, they want to have a purpose, and it's hard to feel like you have a purpose if you've always taken care of people and you can't and you're taking care of others. And I haven't worked in hospice, but I've had a lot of people who are disabled, and there's a similar dynamic there that people often have lost the sense of their worth and what they can give to other people because they're limited. And I think it's important in our life to help people because they do have a purpose. They have a very important purpose that has sort of lost sight of it. And one of the purposes is to give other people the opportunity to be caregivers. For other people to have the opportunity to really thought about if you didn't have any suffering, if you didn't have anyone to take care of, you wouldn't have that opportunity. And when you're limited way now, you can give to others that opportunity, which is a precious, awesome
opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Brian? I have a story.
Okay.
A complicated one.
A complicated story. Okay.
College roommate, Steve. I was good friends with him. And, of course, the end of college, before then, we kind of parted company. I lost contact with him. And then, I don't know, 15 years later, my mother was talking about a friend of theirs who had a daughter, and their daughter was getting connected to this guy who wanted to be a Zen Buddhist priest, and they were all very worried about their daughter and what she was getting herself in for. A couple more years passed, and then one day the phone rang, and it was my friend Steve, and he had been visiting his in-laws. Guess what? His in-laws were the parents of Judy. They had gotten married. And somehow or another, this all took place in Wisconsin, Door County. And Steve's father-in-law had mentioned Chuck Berger. Well, Steve remembered that my father's name was Chuck. He said, oh, that wouldn't be Chuck Berger of Chicago, would it? Turns out it was. So Steve and I were reunited after 20 years or something like that. He came walking down the driveway, and it was good to meet him. He'd been studying with a Korean teacher, whose name I don't know. And Judy was also actually a student. They had two kids, and we got to know Judy and their kids and the family over the course of several years. Steve, at this point, had stopped practicing with his teacher, and first of all, a steam fitter in a shipyard, and then got involved as a computer programmer. The kids were growing. Judy was diagnosed with stomach cancer. And at an early stage in the treatment, Steve decided that he needed to leave his wife, Judy, and they got a divorce. Judy went through chemo and surgery, and she died. A few more years passed. Steve, in fact, met again a woman who was also a student of this Korean teacher, and the two of them got married. And his family kind of came back around Steve, regrouped. And then Steve was diagnosed with cancer. In this case, he had cancer in the eye. and it's a particularly aggressive form of cancer, so they removed the eye, and for a few years, it looked like things were going to be okay, but then, of course, the cancer metastasized. And Steve was in the last days of his life, and in fact, the last days of his life, he spent in meditation in front of them. And that's the way he passed away. Mm. So it's good to have stories of exemplary teachers. Mm. They're motivating. Mm. Teachers can be exemplary in a number of ways.
I think that we need to end now, because I need to change position. This isn't working anymore for me.